week of May 3rd, 2020, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 492, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
Could I have a medium decaf with three creams? Sperling, how do you take your coffee?
Michael, you know, we're live.
No, I know. How do you take your coffee?
Just black, just nothing in it.
Could I have a large black? As people may have heard by now, we are rebranding the show. We are now called Podcasters in a Car Getting Coffee.
So, okay.
Steinfeld is bringing his show to an end, we thought that's a catchy title. Let's use that. We can get in a car, do our show together, get some coffee, make some jokes, have a comedian maybe in the back seat. I just figured it's available. We might as well pick it up. I'm sure we could get it for a song.
You know, I'm pretty sure that's not how copyright works. Once somebody stops using something, doesn't mean copyright is available. Just FYI.
Well, I'll just ask Jerry.
Yeah. Oh, you know him. Okay, great. Yeah, definitely do that. Let me know what he says.
And you, of course, know Nicolas Cage.
Yes, I do. But that's because I used to work.
Nicolas Cage, Tiger King.
Yes, but he thought he was the Tiger King before the Tiger King thought he was the Tiger King. So technically, Nicolas Cage is just taking the throne back.
So he is cast in a limited run series on television that's coming.
That's right.
To play Joe Exotic Tiger King. Not sure about that one.
What do you mean? You don't think that
We don't need that show. We barely needed Tiger King as it was. I'm not sure we need a fictional version of that. I don't see the point, but it'll be nutty.
Yeah, well, I think it's I agree. Plus I don't think Nicolas Cage has ever done TV, at least not to this level.
I don't think headed a miniseries, but that's true. I'm not sure. But it's a breakthrough for him then. He's moved to television right, where all the great work is. And it's a breakthrough for us as we call ourselves, you know, podcasters in car getting coffee. So what are we going to talk about on this show this week while we're in our car drinking coffee?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we are reopening. We're going to throw the doors open. That's right. Okay, we're not really reopening because Michael and I always socially distance by recording the podcast on opposite coasts. That's kind of our rule. We started social distancing. It took, maybe 10 years for it to catch on?
Yeah, that's the way we maintain our friendship. Right. If we were in the same room, we'd kill each other.
We also have no customers, so that also is, you know, kind of...
Makes it easier.
And there's no widespread testing or a vaccine for us. So, yeah. But other than that, we're totally reopening. We've got all our usual features, plus not one, but two guests. That's right. We'll be joined by lawyer Jonathan Handel to discuss the latest news about the WGA battle with talent agencies. And you might recall he's a contributor to The Hollywood Reporter, and he's an entertainment attorney, and he kind of deals with union law. Mm-hmm. And during Inside Baseball, we'll be joined by Jim Amos, who formerly headed up distribution at Sony Pictures, and now is a well-thought-of consultant in the motion picture business. He's going to break down the battle between exhibitors and Universal over collapsing pay windows. Not pay windows, really, just collapsing theatrical windows. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll discuss a few of the week's top headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's video on demand charts.
That's right. We're looking at the video on demand charts in North America alone. We have no figures for these movies. We don't know how much they're grossing by and large, except for Trolls World Tour, which is premium video on demand. But we do know which are the most popular. And we have a new number one this week. The biggest movie this week at video on demand in North America is the Will Smith Martin Lawrence film, Bad Boys for Life. That's at number one. And number two is another new film. It's the Tiffany Haddish comedy, Like a Boss. That's the one with Salma Hayek as a boss, and they're like in a beauty world, and they launch a company, and then she takes it over, and battles ensue. At number three is Harrison Ford, who really needs to stop flying. He is in The Call of the Wild.
Google that, by the way.
Yeah. At number four is The Way Back, Ben Affleck's drama, where he plays a basketball coach. I haven't seen that yet, but I'd like to check it out. At number five is Guy Ritchie's gangster flick, The Gentlemen. That's a lot of men in these top five, isn't there? At number six, finally, another woman, Kristen Stewart, in the underwater sci-fi flick, Underwater. That's what it's called. At number seven is Robert Downey Jr. in Doolittle. At number eight is 1917, the World War I epic film, which I highly recommend. At number nine is the latest remake of Little Women, the latest, but surely not the last. And another 10, another another vehicle for women. It's Harley Quinn, or as its official title runs, Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn. So we have a couple new movies there. We have a fair scattering of vehicles for women. One, two, three, four of them, four out of the 10 are headed by women. So people who say women can't rule the box office, they most certainly can. But Will Smith on top with Bad Boys for Life.
You know, you were talking about Harrison Ford and flying, and he had another incident in one of his many planes. And it dawned on me, you know, if you're a surgeon, generally you have to stop operating when you're 65. They kind of, it's one of those rules. You don't really have to stop, but generally most surgeons are kind of, by most hospitals are kind of shown the door, if you will, at the age of 65. They can do other things, but generally they're... it's kind of frowned upon to be operating. He's almost 80 years old and he's flying around in a plane.
And millions of people who are 80 plus drive a car.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Wigs. I mean, so yeah, so there's no rule for flying as long as you pass your competency exam each year and whatever. He has had a few incidents. He was chided for his latest issue, but I'm not sure of the details of that or whether it indicates any failings in his capabilities as a pilot. But at some point, hopefully people will say, yeah, you know, it's time to wrap it up. Certainly the box office has been shut down, not like Harrison Ford, but just by this horrible pandemic. The Asian box office, these are the numbers we're going to start seeing. They got a report for the first quarter. The Asian box office is down 88%. That's just frightening. You see that number and you have to laugh. It's so awful. 88%. My God.
And every week we go on with this and I was on a webinar, moderated a webinar with Paul DeGarabedian of ComScore just last week. And he was saying each weekend that we're closed, that percentage will increase significantly.
Well, of course, absolutely. And of course, we're moving into the second quarter, aren't we?
Yes.
We do have some cinemas starting to reopen around the world. In South Korea, the largest movie chain, CGV, plans to reopen its 36 theaters. And in the Czech Republic, they've set a date for reopening cinemas of May 25th. That is the first European country to announce an opening date for cinemas.
And I think they're even moving it up. I think they moved it up to May 11th. I could be wrong about that, but I know Norway is opening on Thursday, and Texas opened up over the past week. I did a story for Celluloid Junkie. You always fault me, for not kind of, I don't know, promoting Celluloid Junkie.
I encourage you to cross promote the stories, the great stuff that you do on Celluloid Junkie. I often don't hear about them till a week or two after they've been there.
Right. Well, this was
so the Texas cinemas are reopening. They're doing temperature checks.
Oh, yeah. No, Evo Entertainment, they run these family entertainment centers with bowling and arcades and movie theaters and a bar and a restaurant. And they have a whole phased approach to opening where they, you know, it kind of limits the social distancing toward the very end of it. Of course, they're going to be following health officials' guidelines as to when each phase is over. And the first phase, there's no arcades. They're not doing arcades. They're not doing bowling. Don't touch the bowling balls. Don't touch the video games. They're closed. And they're selling, you know, only 25% capacity of their seats. And every single movie theater chain that's opening in Texas, and Santikos was first, and now we have Evo on today, as a matter of fact. And then I think Showbiz Cinemas is opening and Starplex Cinema Grill is opening. They're opening slowly. They're opening with limited capacity, and they are all making a big deal out of the way they are taking safety and health and sanitation and hygiene into account. They are really being very upfront and open about it. And Evo did a great job of publishing their whole program and actually encouraged other theater owners to take a look at it, poke holes in it, and if needed, copy it.
Can I borrow one of your asterisks? You keep a big supply of them, right?
Asterisks. I don't really know what that is unless you're talking about my obelisk. Asterisks and obelisk.
No, you said you keep a copy when you want to put an asterisk by something. You pop it up there and said you kept a big supply of them. You said that last week or the week before. You pulled one out of your pocket.
Ah, okay, yes. Oh, I do. Yeah. I kind of, you know, that was a throwaway joke that I made on that episode. And I threw it away and totally forgot about it.
Oh. Well, anyway, let's put an asterisk by it. When you say they're following the protocols of health officials, not true. They are following the guidelines set aside by the state. But in fact, the vast majority of health professionals at the national level say it's too damn soon to open up because we don't have widespread.
At the national level, yes, that is correct.
So yes, they are not following the procedures that the smart health, the people in the state who wanted to open up again, the ones who didn't shut it down early enough and are now reopening too soon, are separate. And it's more often not the health professionals in the state. It's usually the politicians. The health professionals say it's too damn soon. We're going to have a huge wave of more deaths and unnecessary ones in June, July, and August and May. There's just a new story. The Trump administration, in their private memos and their private papers, according to the New York Times, they acquired a thing. They are predicting 3,000 deaths a day around the country for the month of May.
Well, I think in that case, you could like look at the world and go, hey, U.S., you're doing a really lousy job.
Well, exactly. But I'm just saying, let's not give them the cover of saying they're listening to the health professionals. In fact, all these states are not. And I feel sorry for the businesses because they're waiting. If they were proper, they would wait for widespread testing and they would wait for, you know, contact tracing officials to be in place so that when there is a flare-up, we could tackle it. They would wait for a proper treatment. And they can't wait for a vaccine, but we could at least have that stuff in place so that if we start to ease the restrictions, we'd be ready to tamp down any city or business or place where there's a flare-up. But they're stuck, right? They're running out of money. They're going to go out of business. And if they wait, they could be waiting forever for proper testing to be
correct
in place, because that's just not happening at the federal level. So I empathize with them. I know they are losing their shirts, but this is not what the health professionals are recommending. Well, you know, as all this stuff is going on, the cinemas are starting to reopen. You know, studios are ready and they're coming up with all these crazy protocols to try and see how can we safely shoot film and television shows without making it all Zoom all the time. And the one thing that's staying open are writer rooms. That's the one thing they can keep going. They're having virtual writer rooms and people are typing away at their homes because they're saying, hey, we can stockpile scripts. We can greenlight TV shows and say, all right, let's just greenlight that show and see what our first 10 scripts look like. You know, let's map out our seasoning, keep going, because scripts are the one thing we can do, which means the Writers Guild of America is at the center of the startup for the film industry.
Well, it's funny you should mention writers, Michael, because actually today we are joined by a longtime friend of the podcast, Jonathan Handel. He's an entertainment and technology attorney. He is of counsel at Troy Gould and a contributing editor to The Hollywood Reporter, where he writes about a lot of union issues. And actually, Jonathan, thank you for joining us. It was a big week for the WGA this week, wasn't it?
Well, it was, and big is not the same as a good week.
It's a big bad week.
It was a difficult time about a week ago for the WGA, is probably the best way of putting it.
Well, to catch people up, the WGA, the Writers Guild of America, is suing the big talent agencies because they say, listen, you shouldn't be doing affiliated production companies. You shouldn't be doing television packaging where you somehow have a profit participation in the shows that our writers are creating and producing. So you shouldn't have that because then you're not actually representing the writers. I'm oversimplifying it, but that's effectively what they're doing. And there was some antitrust issues and some kickback issues. And what did a judge say about that?
Well, just to fill in a little more color, the Writers Guild has two major complaints, the two that you listed. But in the lawsuit, they actually only are suing about packaging fees. They're not suing about affiliate production. And the other piece of color that we should note is that as a result of the Writers Guild having filed suit now a year ago, that's how quickly the legal system works, the agencies, the three major agencies, WME, CAA, and UTA, filed countersuits, which actually now are the primary suits. Now that we're in federal court, things got topsy-turvy, but, you know, regardless of the direction, the point is that both sides are suing the other. Writers Guild tried to get the agency suits dismissed a number of months ago. They lost entirely on that. The agency suits continue. And then the agencies tried to get the Writers Guild claims dismissed. And that's the most recent. The hearing on that was in January. And they're 14 claims that the Writers Guild brought. So we won't go through the whole laundry list. But they attacked, the agencies attacked each of those claims. They attacked the Writers Guild bringing them, and also the Writers Guild had individuals who were bringing claims. And what did the judge say? Well, the judge said, gee, this is confusing. I'll rule eventually. This is a very slow judge, actually. And three months later, the hearing was the end of January. 3 months later, towards the tail end of April, we got a ruling. And the judge said, that virtually all of the Writers Guild claims cannot proceed. The writers, either because the Writers Guild does not have standing to assert those claims on behalf of its members. For example, the Writers Guild never had an agent. The Writers Guild never wrote a script.
So they weren't injured, effectively. They're saying you weren't affected by this. Go get the guy that broke his leg and have the guy who broke his leg sue for his broken leg.
That's right. And you don't have the proper relationship to that guy to be able to bring what in essence would be analogous to a class action, so-called organizational standing, where the organization brings a claim on behalf of its members. And then some of the other claims, the most inflammatory claim that the Writers Guild brought was that packaging fees which are paid by the studios, the employer, to the agency. They brought the claim that these are a form of kickback or bribe that is being paid, by an employer to a representative of a writer, and that amounts to a kickback or a bribe, and also amounts to racketeering. Now, my judgment on that, quite frankly, was that these were clickbait claims. They were exciting for the headlines and garnered the sort of headlines that the Writers Guild wanted of necessity, but that they weren't claims that were going to survive any scrutiny. And in fact, they didn't. The judge said, look, these are in 70 years, this statute has never been applied this way. And, stepping back a bit and looking at it, you say packaging fees are disclosed to the writers, to the showrunner writers, on the budget top sheet, on the budget listing. There's a line item for packaging fees. Now, whoever heard of a bribe or kickback that said, here's your budget, bribe, $1 million, or whatever. It's like, I don't think so.
Campaign donation.
Those are not illegal. I mean, right. For better and for worse in many cases, but they're not illegal, and you have disclosure. And here, you have disclosure. It's just not—it's not racketeering. This is not mafia activity. And it really was at the point where, at one point, in a meeting between the Writers Guild negotiators and the agencies, the agent, one of the agents, president of one of the agencies, whose clients were on the other side of the room, said to them, "Are you really saying that there's no difference between us and the mafia?" And not a single person in the Writers Guild room responded to that. And that's really a sign of how in extremis this dispute has gone, that instead of saying, this is a business dispute, we think economically XYZ. And by the way, the trouble with the Writers Guild position is it's been a lot of hand waving. They have never even alluded to any evidence, given us the whiff of evidence that packaging fees, in fact, reduce writers' compensation. I'm not saying they don't. The agencies have given evidence in the other direction.
But couldn't you see how the perspective of it kind of, when you think about it, it just looks bad to have the person that's supposed to be representing you also benefiting from basically, I need to keep costs down because I'm a profit participant in this, and actually paying you is kind of eating into the profits that I would get a percentage of.
The optics are disturbing. That's true. Remember, though, that another piece of the optics that has to be factored in is the writer, if he were not being packaged, would pay a 10% commission. The writer does not pay commission when there are packaging fees. So immediately, the writer is saving 10% of what can be very large numbers. In order to prove that the writer is getting screwed by this, by packaging fees, you have to overcome a 10% hurdle just to begin with.
Well, we can do it the simple way by saying the agencies wouldn't give them that if they'd make more money by just taking their 10% fee. They're obviously making more money off packaging, or they would just take their 10% fee and be done with it.
There is some question about that. That is an argument, but that's not an argument that actually shows the math. That's a hypothetical, and it's arguing that the agency's hypothetical is in their own interest and not in the and doesn't work for the writers. What about the argument that the writer, by saving money up front, is giving up a piece of the back end that is very speculative as to whether there ever will be a back end? The way packaging fees work is that there is an there's a portion that gets paid to the agency when the episode is produced, and that portion does not necessarily bring the agency into a better position than they would have been with the 10%. Then there's a portion that gets paid to the writers and to the agency in the event that the show goes into profits. Most shows don't go into profits. Most of them don't. And that's true even more so now because there are fewer aftermarkets for shows. Instead of shows going on network and then going into syndication, they go directly to Netflix, and there's no aftermarket. In fact, in part, a bizarre thing about this lawsuit and the fact that it's gone so nuclear is it's a fight over something, first of all, that the Writers Guild accepted for 43 years because packaging was permitted, it's explicitly permitted under the previous agreement between the agencies and the Writers Guild, which the Writers Guild then terminated that agreement as of last April, a year ago. But in addition, it's essentially fighting yesterday's battle, a battle that was much more relevant 10 years ago than today in the age of streamers.
Wait,
and in
fact, you mean that somehow a guild will fight for VHS rights and VHS dividends just as DVD and Blu-ray take off? Never.
Well, what they fought for was DVD and Blu-ray revenues just as those were fading away. And streaming was coming in.
But maybe because they're acting from a position of weakness, whereas the studios and the talent agencies have a lot more power than individual writers. And it's also true that even in the heyday of syndication, vastly popular shows would be told, oh, we haven't made any money yet. So writers are constantly fighting to prove that shows are profitable. Apparently, studios and talent agencies make shows endlessly and movies endlessly, even though they're losing their shirt. They never seem to make a profit.
If they're telling the writer that there's no profits, that is, if the studio is telling the writer that there's no profits, then they're telling the agency the same thing, because the agency's profit definition parallels that of the showrunner. So the issue of studios being engaging in a hide the walnut when it comes to whether a show is in profit or not is actually an issue that agencies have against the studios as well. And you have lawsuits where the writer and the agency are suing the studio. So that isn't really so much a part of the writer versus agency dispute as the question of when a show, you know, is the whole arrangement better or worse for, you know, for writers. And I think, you know, and I want to be clear, I'm not saying that it's not. I'm saying that the Writers Guild has not even tried to prove its case beyond pointing, you know, in essence, the optics, and then saying this is worse for writers because we say it is and we have evidence, but we're not going to really show you.
Well, looking at where we're at right now, this is a court battle, but it is sort of the side tactical maneuver, whereas the negotiating table is where they're really going to hash all of this out. And right now, of course, we're facing a pandemic. UTA just announced they are furloughing employees. While this continues, and the Writers Guild and the talent agencies and the studios are all negotiating and trying to work all this stuff out amidst a work stoppage that is beyond everyone's control. So writers are still writing, but in essence, everyone wants to get back to work. And I guess the question is, who's in a better position right now? Writers, of course, have writers who've seen their income slow down, perhaps, and they want to get back to work. But talent agencies and studios also want to get back to work. Does this really push everyone to try to come to a fair agreement, or is this just a monkey in the, you know, throwing a wrench in the works that's just creating a havoc for everybody?
Well, to finish your metaphor, it does kind of throw a wrench in the monkey, or at the monkey.
The monkey can always duck. Just remember,
yeah. The monkey can always duck. And in fact,
can you get anything done amidst all this chaos? I guess is my question.
The writers are also, I mean, and you sort of half alluded to this. The writers are about to negotiate with the studios for renewal of their contract, which just got extended to June 30th. It got off to a rocky start when the executive director of the Writers Guild sent a letter to the head of the Studio Alliance and said, "You people are despicable."
Jacques Hughes,
you know, which, you know, it was quite extraordinary. I mean, maybe dastardly, but Despicable seemed like strong medicine. And, you know, people were, it wasn't productive. It wasn't perceived as productive, certainly. But they are going to, they are on for May 11th. In fact, they exchanged proposals, were set to have exchanged proposals May 1st, a number of days ago. And we assume that they did so. So, meanwhile, SAG right now, SAG-AFTRA, is currently in negotiations with the studios. So they'll, I guess, be swapped out because I don't think they'll finish by May 11th. It's all being done, you know, the negotiations between the unions and the studios typically involve about upwards of 100 people in a room together.
Oh, yeah.
Because there are all sorts of hangers-on and a peanut gallery of you know, aides and staffers and so forth.
That's a big Zoom meeting.
Well, so the Zoom meetings
are
smaller.
Sounds easy to me. How hard could it be?
The fact that they're doing it at all via Zoom is extraordinary, actually. It really is amazing that they're able, you know, they must have, I don't know how many people they have on the Zoom meeting, and I'm sure it's not the whole contingent, but the fact that they're able to do it at all of them from their homes, you know, as well. You can't sort of nudge the person next to you and say, well, remember, talk about XYZ. You know, I mean,
text handling.
You can text them. That's right. It's extraordinarily difficult circumstances. The agencies and the writers, though, as far as they are concerned, they haven't had negotiations in, I don't know, in months, many months. And that looks to be just a continuing court battle, which will take, unless there's some settlement, it could take another 2 to 3 years counting appeals to resolve.
Well, I mean, does this make a writer strike less likely? The pandemic and well, just everything.
There'll be no writer strike. They're not going to strike. I mean, there's the writer strike. What are the issues that? So again, that's with the studios, not with the agencies. They're on a sort of strike with the agencies now. They fired their agents, most of them, you know, a year ago. Although some have come back to the agents in violation of the rules, we're told. In terms of a strike, you know, they're going to get there. They will probably get the same wage increases that the DGA got, which were by guild standards, hefty wage increases, three and even 3.5% increases. They, even though the economy has collapsed since the DGA deal was done, it's viewed by observers as being likely that with some kicking and fighting that they'll probably get pretty much that. They'll get the residual provisions that the DGA got because those are usually pattern bargaining. There are writer specific issues in terms of holds and exclusivity and stuff, and they'll probably get some incremental improvement on the language they've gotten in the last rounds of negotiation. What's left? What are they going to strike over? It just doesn't. And how are they going to strike? At six, you know, a picket line with 6 foot intervals. It's highly, highly unlikely that there's going to be a writer's strike.
And do you think there's going to be any changes for how you do business? Do you feel like Zoom meetings and virtual meetings are going to become a lot more common in the future? Or will you start to get back to face-to-face because there's such a value in that that you lack when you are trying to meet with clients or other attorneys and doing it via a video conferencing?
Well, a lot of my work was done via telephone. A lot of attorneys' work is done via telephone to begin with. The number of times that a client wants to, you know, schlep into the office and have a meeting is, you know, it's not an everyday occurrence at all. So yeah, no, I think that video will become more common. And the bigger question, of course, is not so much, you know, workers like lawyers like myself, but, you know, how is production in this industry, you know, going to work? Because writers are still working to a fair extent, actually, because they can work, you know, in virtual video, you know, video writers' rooms, virtual writers' rooms. But production can't be conducted that way. And in addition, of course, cinema going is essential for the economic performance of big budget movies, which are all that the studios, essentially all that the studios make, the big studios, and all they can afford to make. A studio, you know, I mean, Universal Studios can't say, you know, or Disney say, well, we'll make all our Marvel content for streaming. It doesn't pencil out economically. They can't say.
I think
say,
that what well, you've created well, is a wonderful segment for Jimmy Fallon or any of the late night talk shows where they try and reenact or create their next movie via Zoom, like Mission Impossible, the Zoom version. Where
That's right. I mean, it's just, and you know, and the other, just to fill in the blank, the other thing Disney can't do is they can't say, well, we'll make all our theatrical movies be art house movies. Because even if every one of them is profitable, it doesn't move the needle enough to pay the rent for the sound stages. And in the case of, you know, a Universal and a Warner Brothers, it not only doesn't pay the rent, it doesn't make enough of a difference on the balance sheet of the parent corporation.
You can't make a theme park ride out of 12 Years a Slave.
And you can't, I mean, you can't impress your corporate overlords at AT&T in Dallas, if you're Warner Brothers, by saying, you know, we made a profit this year on 10 art house movies that adds up to, you know, $70 million. Mm-hmm. We made a $70 million. Every one of them is profitable. Well, good for you. But you know, what is that? You know, that's a small city's worth of telephone lines. That doesn't interest us.
Enjoy your future at A24. Yes.
Right. A24. If they made 10 art house pictures in a row and they were all profitable, A24 is very happy. It's a different business.
Yep.
Well, and I appreciate you, and I'm speaking for Michael, as I always tend to do towards the end of one of these interviews, but I appreciate you stopping by to tell us about the business of the Writers Guild of America and what the most recent ruling kind of against them in their battle with talent agencies really means and what might happen next.
Well, it very much is against them. I mean, just to complete that thought, the Writers Guild was essentially ousted from its own lawsuit. And notwithstanding the statements they put out that said, we won a wonderful victory because we can continue with discovery, with the process of demanding documents from the agencies and internal memos and emails, that discovery is highly likely to be limited just to the individuals whose claims persist, whose claims were allowed to move forward. So if writer Jane Smith, who was one of the individuals, just make up a name, if she was lied to about packaging fees, that's relevant. But whether or not some other writer, Bob Jones, who's not part of the lawsuit, whether or not he was lied to or what the agencies did with him, it's not relevant. They're not going to get discovery on the whole agency practice. You're just a discovery on what happened to you. That turns this into a big fizzle.
Well, I'm no lawyer, but being ousted from your own lawsuit sounds like a bad thing. So we look forward to having you back next time to hear about all the stories that come up in the legal world crossing with the entertainment business. So stay safe, stay isolated, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, guys.
Well, that was great of Jonathan Handel to join us. He's a big deal, you know, in the lawyering world.
Oh, I see what you're doing. You're trying to move us along. I do love talking to Jonathan Handel because he is always so pointed about this kind of like labor stuff in the entertainment industry. But what you were really trying to do there in one swift move that I just totally screwed up is move us along into Big Deal or Big Whoop. Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, like here's what I want to know, and I've been wondering about this myself. People are turning to ESPN, seeing reruns of stone skipping and Tetris competitions and asking themselves, why the heck am I paying for this? The New York Attorney General agrees, saying people should get a refund from ESPN when no sports are on. But cable ain't the only game in town. Amazon just signed a new streaming deal with the NFL. They'll continue to simulcast Thursday Night Football on Amazon Prime, and now they'll get an exclusive game on Saturdays for the first time. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. You know, if you don't like a channel that you choose to pay for, stop paying for it. There's, you know, and what about major networks during the summers when they have?
I don't think you can turn off ESPN. I think you
most certainly can. You don't have to pay for any cable. It's your choice. Major networks during the summer, mostly reruns. You still paid for them. ESPN right now is showing The Last Dance, a Michael Jordan documentary film. So they can say, hey, we spent a lot of money to promote this major documentary film that's airing in prime time right now. I mean, I empathize. I agree. Your cable bill is too high, but nobody's forcing you to pay for it. So you can't possibly argue that they should get reruns because you happen to be at a downtime. That happens for every channel in America. There are lots of channels that have mostly reruns. So when do you decide?
TV Land is a network based on reruns.
Right. So when do you decide that, you know, there aren't enough original content going on right now? And so in June, you should get a rerun, but in September, you don't. It would be a minefield. It's impossible to argue for because nobody is forcing you to pay for it. So I empathize. I agree, but it ain't going to happen.
Now, global revenue for recorded music hit $20 billion in 2019. That's an 8% increase over 2018, but it also shows that the growth powered by streaming is, well, it's slowing down, frankly. And any future increases will likely come from territories where music streaming subscriptions, that is, well, they bring in a lot less revenue than places like, say, Sweden and Western Europe and North America. For the fifth consecutive year, Latin America is the fastest growing region in the music business. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I don't think the slowdown is a big deal. I think that's a big whoop. This is what we expect to happen. We're in a lot of mature markets. And so how are they going to increase revenue? They're going to increase their audience by expanding into other countries, but those countries will not support the same high price. So they're going to see a lowering of the per subscriber revenue that they're getting. That's fine. And they're going to see global revenue continue to increase, just not as at fast a pace. Otherwise, they should raise prices, spin off services devoted to jazz and classical and the like. I think that would all be minimal. At some point, they're going to have to raise the prices to, say, $12 or $14. But what I really hope they do is improve sound quality. So Amazon made a bold move there, but unfortunately, they charged extra for it. I hope Spotify and Apple Music step up to the plate and say, hey, we're going to improve your sound quality across the board, do an even better job just for the same great service you already have.
Right. The big issue really that was announced last week is that Spotify's ARPU, their average revenue per user, though they're making more money, they're making less from each of their users.
And that's a good thing because that means they are expanding into India and Africa and Latin America and countries where they cannot pay $10 a month. So that's exactly what you expect and want to happen. That means they're bringing in more people because they haven't lowered their prices anywhere. They're just bringing in new subscribers at a new level.
You know, I wonder how much Daniel Ek, the CEO of Spotify, made last year. Because you know what? It is, Michael, your favorite time of year. The quarter when major companies reveal how much money they've been shoveling into the pockets of their hardworking CEOs. AMC Networks' Josh Sapin, he got a cool 20 mil. And that's mil with an M. Now, that was just for 2019. That was his compensation. Salaries, by the way, are just the tip of the iceberg, by the way. Remember stock options? Remember those little things?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and Discovery's David Zaslav had a terrible year. A terrible, terrible year.
Poor
his
guy.
Pay was cut. Not just put. It was cut by $84 million because in 2018, he got a huge pile of bonuses and his total compensation hit $129 million. So now this year, he's only getting, now get this, Michael, I know, please sit down because you're going to be really like upset that, you know, he's being paid so little. He only got $45 million. Can you believe that? I mean, he should quit.
We need a Kickstarter for him.
Yeah, maybe a GoFundMe or something.
GoFundMe, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop because nobody will care. No one will pay attention. In Deadline, there's a great story by Jill Goldsmith on CEO pay and how untenable it should be during the pandemic and during the way the world is right now. You look at all these companies and every time they write about how many people they're furloughing, how many people they've laid off permanently, we should also be remembering how much their top guys are getting paid. What if you suggested, see, maybe they could get by in $1 million a year? Well, their jaws would drop. That is an unconscionable, insane suggestion that you could find someone to run a company like Discovery for $1 million a year and find a quality person. No, nobody would bother. Nobody, you couldn't find anyone to do it. That's what they will tell you, and it's not true.
So what you're saying really is that you do not believe in a free and open market.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what we don't have at these companies.
Well, now YouTube probably faces the same issue as Facebook and Twitter, which is a story I just skipped over, by the way.
We skipped over a story saying Facebook has a lot of users, and so does Twitter, but their ad revenue is falling. Now move on to this one.
Okay, well then YouTube probably faces the same ad issue as Facebook and Twitter, but at least it has a hit on its hands. Liberal muckraker Michael Moore produced and promoted a new film on global warming that dropped right on the eve of Earth Day, and it's a hit called Planet of the Humans. Wait a second. 20th Century Fox called and they want their title back.
Yeah.
It's directed by Jeff Gibbs and is no update to An Inconvenient Truth. Far from it, the film is anti-green energy and filled with factual errors and claims that haven't been true for like, I don't know, you know, like a decade. Okay. But people are watching it. The movie is available for free on YouTube and has racked up 6.1 million views and counting. Although what really does count for a view on YouTube? Let's ask that question. I still don't know. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop because I can answer that question for you. YouTube counts 5 seconds of a video, whatever its length, as a view, which means I have watched this movie twice because I've clicked on it twice just to see where it was and let it run for a few seconds. So two of those views are mine, even though I have not watched the film. So we have no idea how many people have watched it completely, but we do know that a lot of people have weighed in with a lot of serious and specific factual problems with this film. It's pretty junky. So it's a shame that Michael Moore associated with it. He's not, a lot of people on the progressive left don't like Michael Moore. They don't like that he's a showman. They don't like that he makes money off these issues. But I think he's a good muckraker, and his films, whatever you think of the conclusions he draws, whatever you think of his presentation, they have held up to extraordinary scrutiny. All people on the right can say, I don't like it. You know, that they have not found a lot of factual errors or things taken out of context.
Well, I mean, there was this stuff in Roger and Me that was taken out of order, where he like kind of re-edited the film, which he admitted to.
Right. Again, nothing has, you know, yes, Roger and Me, the whole conceit of the movie was that I'm going to show up and just ask for a meeting. It's silly. It's absurd. Nobody actually believes he was going to walk in and get a meeting with the CEO of General Motors. That doesn't happen. So the entire conceit of the film is a bit of a put on, but that's made clear up front. We're all in on the joke there. Of course, you don't walk into a major corporation and get a meeting with the boss. That doesn't happen. But all of his movies since then, including that one, Bowling for Columbine, Fahrenheit 9/11, and so on and so forth, they have withheld intense scrutiny by and large. You can find a few little things, but by and large, he does not play the games with facts. He doesn't take a lot of things out of context. He isn't screwing around with the editing to make people look bad. They don't. Even if you disagree with him, that's simply not, he's had a good track record. This film that he is supporting has a lot of major problems with it. There are substantial complaints about this. You know, they're quoting statistics for a solar panel from 2008, which is incredibly outdated. And this is a tiny example. There are hundreds of them if you look online. So I think it's a shame he's associated with the film, that it doesn't hold up to the same standards he holds for his films. And it's damaging and bad. But again, my main point is, when you're talking about how popular things are, don't listen to Netflix and YouTube's rating metric, 5 seconds, that's a joke.
As expected, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences made some rule changes for next year's awards. First, they said that you have to give an award to both Michael and I for anything. Yay! It doesn't matter. Yeah, yay. No, they didn't do that. They did get rid of the need for a theatrical release. Hold on, AMC, before you get your... get your popcorn in a bunch. Get a bunch of popcorn.
Keep going.
Anyway, movies must demonstrate they intended to do a theatrical release, so you won't see a flood of Lifetime movies becoming eligible. And so what if they did? What if they did,
Who cares?
Yeah. Netflix can get a 1 week theatrical run for any film it wants, so nothing has really changed for streamers. And studios can't get a theatrical release for many films right now, so the rules had to change, really, just for this 1 year. And as soon as the pandemic is over, the rules go back to the way they were. One other rule change is permanent, however. The Oscar categories of sound mixing and sound editing have been combined into best sound. How does that sound to you, Michael? Big deal or big whoop?
See, I'm making a little. I'm making some little sound effects
there.
Are
you like a Foley artist now?
Exactly. Okay. So the combination of sound mixing and sound editing can be blamed on our ignorance for how to define those different categories. A lot of people didn't understand it, and a fair amount of the time there would be good overlap between the two groups. So you'd see someone come up and get a sound mixing award, and they'd also be part of the team doing sound editing. Though those are very different and distinct creative endeavors. One creates sound effects; the other one decides at what levels to mix in the score, the dialogue, the sound effects, and other sound elements. So it's an understandable change. There are still some people in the sound world that aren't happy about it, but I think it makes sense overall. I hope they don't feel slighted. And I also hope that they've opened up a category. There's no reason not to add something long overdue, like best stunts, best casting director, and some other people who have been there for 100 years and contributing to movies and not been able to be recognized.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And boy, this week, they really might affect you. Just to catch people up, Universal Pictures was about to release the big budgeted animated film Trolls World Tour. That's a mouthful. Now, they were about to do that when the pandemic hit. And since the studio had already spent big bucks promoting the film, they decided to push it straight to premium VOD, premium video on demand. The same route that other studios took with some new films that were released but barely seen or about to come out. And these were movies that were like in theaters, like Emma. They put on premium video on demand for $20. But Universal surprised exhibitors with the announcement, crowed about how much money they made with the movie, and then loudly insisted, hey, you know what? They plan to do it again going forward because, hey, why not? They made so much money. They're going to do day and date PVOD and theatrical releases. Well, yeah, yikes. Now major chains are pushing back. AMC says it won't carry any Universal films. Of course, AMC, the big North American theater chain, largest theater chain in the world. They also own Odeon in the EU. They own the Nordic Cinema Group in the EU. Regal and Cineworld repeated their longstanding practice, which is if a studio plans to release a film online without the traditional 90-day theatrical window, they simply will not carry it either. To break this down, we're joined by Jim Amos, an executive with more than three decades of experience in all areas of the movie industry. He was ultimately president of distribution at Sony Pictures and is the founder of Scout 53, a motion picture industry consulting group. He's a contributor to Forbes. He's also a contributor, full disclosure, to Celluloid Junkie. Jim, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Sperling. Thanks for having me on.
And welcome to the birds that are chirping in the background behind you. Just in case people are wondering what that is, Jim's also a world-class ornithologist, but we'll get to that some other time.
I hate to brag, Michael. Yeah.
So we've got this case going on, and I don't see there's any way to slice it. And then Universal seems to have, whatever they plan to do, they seem to have done it in the clumsiest fashion possible at every stage. The first stage was not consulting with them, of course, and surprising them with their announcement, which would not have caught them by surprise since other people were doing it and it made sense in this unusual circumstance.
Yeah, I would agree. And that's really where this all emanated from, Michael. They did it without talking to exhibitors, which, as those of us in the industry know, when you're going to do something this big and you don't consult with your exhibition partners, and I use that term loosely because it's a term that both exhibitors and studios like to throw around, but it's not one that that is adhered to too often. But when you do it without any kind of consideration on something like this, you're really asking for trouble. And unfortunately, every step of the way, they seem to have done what can only be considered the wrong move. And they had a chance to kind of cool everything down by coming out with a clear-cut statement that, no, this was just, you know, one-off because of what's going on, and we are still 100% behind theatrical windows and intend to release all of the films that we were going to release in theaters, but that was not forthcoming, and they've seemed to have kind of fumbled and stumbled all the way here.
They added kerosene to the fire. They said, wow, we made a ton of money. They rarely announce, to put this in context, studios rarely announce how much money they make on DVD and Blu-ray and video rentals. They like to keep that information very close to the chest. And so not only did they announce how much money they made, hey, we made $95 million in the first 14 days. So we're going to do this again. As soon as movie theaters reopen, by God, we're going to release them both day and date. And then exhibitors had the nerve, when exhibitors complained, they had the nerve to say, oh, you're misinterpreting us. I'm like, no, I can read too. And that's exactly what you said.
Yeah, you're right. And like I had mentioned before, it is what you said. And you had every opportunity to walk it back and say the right thing, and you chose not to. And a lot of the terminology that Jeff Shell used was really head scratching. When you hear something like, theatrical will someday be a central element to their company. Hasn't it kind of always been? And, you're not saying that playing films on, on the wall inside your house is going to someday be a critical element. This is something that has been for 100 years and will continue to be. I didn't realize this had to be actually stated, and the whole someday is what really kind of throws this up for debate, because what in the world does that mean? And like I said, it comes on the heels of will release on both formats.
But don't you think that Jeff Shell, don't you think somehow Jeff Shell always seems to me to be the guy? He is Comcast first. You know, he is a cable guy. He, that's where he started. That's kind of where his allegiances are. And of course he wants premium VOD. It really helps Comcast. In fact, right now they're launching Peacock, the NBC kind of streaming service. And where do they launch it? In Oregon to Comcast customers. So if you're a Spectrum customer, you might want to subscribe, but you can't. And so that said, he almost always seems to be like the guy who says something that the rest of the company just slaps their forehead and goes, "Oh, Jeff, why did you say it that way? You did not take what we were expecting you to take from that meeting." Like he attended half a meeting, got like 50% of it, and then makes a statement and then basically leaves Universal Pictures or NBC or whoever it is to clean up after him.
You're right. And I think maybe the onus should have been on somebody like Donna Langley to clean it up. And, you know, even if Jeff wasn't capable or didn't want to say the right thing afterwards, you could always leave it to Donna to say, we are going to continue exactly the way that we had prior to the pandemic. After the pandemic starts to lessen a bit in theater,
and Donna Langley being the head of Universal Pictures,
I don't know what they all thought was going to happen, but a lot of people who were kind of surprised by how out in the media this is played shouldn't be, because if you do this unilaterally and just pretty much say to exhibitors, "The heck with you," I don't fault Adam Aaron, to be quite honest, to say, okay, you want to play it that way? Let me lay down the gauntlet saying, we're not going to play you, and you're going to have to explain to your producers, to your directors, to your stars, how you're not going to get 1,100 theaters worldwide. And what I want to be in on the conversation with is when Universal picks up the phone and calls Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson and says, oh, on our first time out for a bond, internationally, we're not going to have all of these screens for you because of our because we want to put
Peacock,
Peacock, and also we want to put the new Purge on PVOD. You know, Barbara Broccoli is going to turn around and say, "I don't give a you know what you want to do with your minor league titles. This is Bond, and you better have the 1,100 AMC theaters that we thought we were going to have when we signed up with you guys."
Well, now, I am not terribly sympathetic to the push to do day and date or stuff like that for the big studio movies. We already have it for documentaries and art films and foreign language films and independent films. That's not going to go away. That's part of the ecosystem for years now. But when you're looking at big studio films, I still feel like even if it's a flop, you're in theaters for 4 weeks, which means you're talking about 8 weeks later, you're on video on demand. So that's only if a movie's a flop, it's going to be out of the theaters in 4 weeks. So I just don't feel, I feel like it's pretty quick now. So I'm not quite sure why there's such a desperate desire and need to have a bigger budget movie like King of Staten Island or The True History of the Kelly Gang coming to video on demand so quickly. I feel like theatrically still has value. But has something changed? When you look at the numbers, do you just say, oh, this is such an unusual circumstance for reasons A, B, and C? Or do you say, well, you know what? They made $100 million. They get to keep 80% of it rather than 50% of revenue. Have they demonstrated anything here about the fact that maybe this is the wave of the future and that there's a demand for it that we didn't realize?
You know what? I think that the demand has just been pushed up, Michael. I think that, you know, a few years back, 75 to 90 days pretty much was a good number for most people to have to wait. But we've become such an immediate consuming society that once it kind of passes, it passes. And if people want it 28 days after release, 45 days after release, and they don't get it, I think that the studios are realizing that they may not get them in the numbers that they did before. So it's got to get into people's hands quicker than it had in prior decades.
Well, but we've seen video on demand go in the opposite direction. As NATO or argued, video on demand or transactional video is kind of the past. It's gone from $25 billion in 2004 to just $9 billion in 2019. $9 billion is still good money, but the trend seems to be in the very opposite direction, because people already have access. They're paying $10 a month for Netflix and Hulu and maybe Peacock. So maybe they don't feel the need to pay for individual movies at $4 a pop because they've got all this content to watch already. So it seems like it's moving in the opposite direction.
Yeah. And I'm always in the, of the opinion that this Trolls was truly even more of a one-off than we think it was. Because if you're asking a family to pay $20 for their kids to watch Trolls, you can probably justify that during these times. But if you have four or five other studios doing this, making their films available for PVOD at $20, the first time somebody gets their cable bill and they see charges of $100, $200 that they didn't have before because their kids had to watch five films instead of one, whoever's paying that bill is going to go through the roof and they're going to go, enough. So, you know, I could see doing it once a month, maybe twice a month, but you're right. I mean, the demand for something other than a one-off, I think, is still limited. But I think that what we're talking about as far as window shrinkage, I think, is more for streaming than it is for PVOD. I think that's, though they won't say it, I think that is where exhibitors worry the most. They're not worried too much about the PVOD because, like I said, you can't have every studio going PVOD for $20 4 weeks into a run. But they worry about it showing up on Netflix, Amazon, Peacock, HBO Max, etc. That's the real concern, even if they don't want to announce
Disney Plus.
And Disney Plus, yes.
Well, in 19 days, Universal is saying that Trolls World Tour made $95 million. And I guess that was 20% down from the theatrical release of the first Trolls movie. Now, I guess you could argue, well, yes, but they got to keep like 80% of that revenue. So they actually still made as much money by keeping the $70 to $80 million that they got from that as they did from the $150 million that Trolls, you know, the first Trolls made. But think of it this way. Right now, Universal Pictures has a captive audience, and I literally mean captive. They are literally stuck at home. This is the biggest kind of chance they have. They're not going to get more people that are, you know, are literally a captivated audience to do this, and they are starving for anything to do, whether it's going to the grocery store or watching a new film release, and yet they only made $95 million.
You're absolutely right, Sperling. And I will be the first one to say that I'd be embarrassed to tell you what I've watched during these last 6 to 8 weeks. So, you know, the captive audience comment is right spot on. And to just address the 95 million number, A, we have no verification on that. We have no point of reference. It's not like there's a weekend PVOD box office chart that, you know, Paul DeGarabedian puts out every Monday. So, you know, that's wonderful. But what does that mean? But the bigger issue is that, okay, it's 20% below domestic. Domestic did 150. What about the 190 from international that
right.
The original Trolls did? And as we've seen with a lot of the non-Pixar films, when you have a sequel, an animated sequel, like the Ice Ages, et cetera, you right. look to see what percentage of that worldwide revenue is coming from international. And as the numbers go to 2, 3, 4, and 5, the percentages go from 60 to 65 to 75. Sometimes one of the Ice Ages was 82%. International over domestic. So that's great that it's, you know, they claim that it's doing close to what the original did domestically, but where are the international numbers? What does that mean? How is it being released internationally? They certainly can't get anything out of China.
Plus, they spent 30 to 60 to 80 to $100 million perhaps in promoting the movie without a theatrical run. So it's the straight-to-video movie with the biggest marketing budget of all time.
Well, and they also think about it on every platform, whether it was Amazon Prime or Apple's iTunes store, it was the front and center film that was being promoted because it was basically every transactional video provider wanted to promote that Fandango. Now, it didn't matter which provider you went to. It was there saying, hey, rent me, rent me, rent me, along with Emma and The Invisible Man and all of the other premium VOD titles. So you could not get better promotion in a time when everybody is turning on their video streaming services.
Yeah. And in addition, they already had their outdoor advertising set up. I mean, when you drive around Los Angeles, you see them on bus shelters, you see them on billboards, et cetera. During this time when there's a lot of companies who can't afford to advertise, those trolls' bus shelters
stayed up
and are going to stay up for a while because there ain't nothing to replace them with. There's certainly no new movies coming out that's going to replace those bus shelters and billboards. So, you know, it's almost like they probably thought they were going to buy 3 weeks of outdoor advertising or 2 weeks of outdoor advertising and have gotten 2 months worth. I mean, yeah, talk about free advertising. And like you said, you can't miss it anywhere.
I was a little surprised to see that Judd Apatow's comedy, The King of Staten Island, they decided to move straight to PVOD. I mean, it's Judd Apatow. Why would they do that?
And the Russell Crowe film, the True History of the Kelly Gang, a period Western from a great novel. Again, a film like King of Staten Island that really needs and benefits from the visibility of a theatrical run and all the critical reviews. I was scratching my head over that one, too.
Yeah, they are a little surprising, especially for me, the Judd Apatow one. I mean, you would think that his name would be able to get, you know, a certain theatrical, at least domestic theatrical break going and decent revenue. That was a little odd, but I have also heard that the film is just okay, and that might have had something to do with it, you know. A lot of times, and we touched about this earlier, people are talking about things going to PVOD and are just astonished as if this has never happened before. I mean, when I was at Sony, we constantly had meetings about whether said film was going to go theatrical or whether it was going to go straight to video. And you know, we probably had a good four or five of them every year, which we had originally had on a theatrical release schedule, which we decided not worth the P&A. It's not worth tying up our release schedule. It's going to cut into the run of, you know, the latest Spider-Man, whatever. There are myriad reasons why it should have gone straight to video, and it did. And so it's nothing new.
But they didn't usually star Russell Crowe.
No, you're right.
They weren't usually Oscar bait movies with, you know, big pedigrees or a film from one of your top filmmakers, Judd Apatow, who's going to create other comedies for you. And obviously he would have signed off on it or they wouldn't have done it, I assume.
Yeah, I would assume. So there had to be an okay from him to go. And those answers were probably not going to have as the why.
Well, here's my Solomon-like bargaining agreement that I want to make between the studios and the exhibitors. I don't think Universal wants to rush Fast and Furious 9 to video on demand or premium video on demand. I don't think they're stupid enough to say, well, after 4 weeks, we want to make it available on video. Maybe they do, but that would seem pretty dumb to me since it's going to have a worldwide play and make maybe $1 billion. But exhibitors, I don't know why they object so strongly on a case-by-case basis. If they stop showing a film, if a film is a flop and the studio has spent money to promote it and they've put it in theaters, and after 4 weeks, essentially no one is carrying it anymore, why not let them just jump right into video on demand? Do they have to have a rule like every movie goes 30 days? But if a movie basically falls out of theaters or, you know, is down to less than 100 screens after opening up on 1,000, that should trigger something where they say, if we want to, we can put it on video on demand because you don't want to show it anymore. If you wanted to show it and kept it on screen, we'd be happy to stay with you. But since you're not showing it, let us take it to video on demand. At least people will remember the marketing money we spent at theatrical. And who would object? I mean, if the movie's a flop and you're not showing it in theaters, why would they care?
I will actually add to your comment, because I have said this for a very long time, and I've been screaming into the wind, and people are just like, you said VOD. I stopped hearing you the moment you said VOD, so I didn't hear anything else you said. So, you know, if you look at Walmart, if you look at Costco, I mean, yes, they all like to have their exclusive products because that's the reason people come into the stores. Effectively, a movie theater is a retail outlet for content, and it has exclusive product. So just follow me here for a second. If you take that content and you say, okay, we're going to allow you, AMC, to sell this content exclusively in your brick and mortar, on your shelf in the brick and mortar buildings there. But then for 12 weeks, we're not going to say it's an earlier release window or home entertainment release window or VOD release window, but we're going to say for 12 weeks, you have the ability to sell this product, this content, any way you can, both physically in a movie theater, or if it's really not working out, you know what? You have your own VOD platform. You do the transactional VOD. People can come to you to see it, and they will be supporting your cinema chains.
But you don't want to undercut the people that you're already doing business with, all the cable companies and all the deals you have. They have a very weak distribution of digital movies. So I don't think they want to depend on Fandango Now to be their, you know, release video on demand.
Yeah. It has been working for independent cinemas during this time period where they're showing these films that would have come out theatrically or had been out theatrically, and they're now showing them. Of course, the only the shelf space they have is virtual, so they're only showing the transactional VOD, and it is working for them. And it does go back to support the theater, and they're selling them at $12 and $10 for for basically a rental.
Yeah, there's a couple of questions in there. The last one, what I always got at Sony from our people was that each transaction that did not go through a partner of theirs as far as VOD it was an issue because you would be taking revenue away from that deal that you secured with Comcast, whoever it is. And so they were always very hesitant to do something like that, Sperling. And as far as the 30-day question you had, Michael,
or just once you stop carrying it, even if it's 6 weeks, yeah, 7 weeks.
Yeah. And we tried that several times, and we didn't even say 30 days. We just basically said once it got down to a certain level under a certain number of screens. And what we got back was logic, which I could kind of see, but was just used for their own benefit as well. And that is, if you regularly take a film that isn't doing well off the screen after 30 days and send it to streaming, to VOD, whatever the case may be, you ingrain in a moviegoer the idea during the second or the third week, oh, you know what? I'm not going to go see this movie that's not doing well because I just have to wait another 8 days and it'll show up on VOD or on streaming. So it's not as if everybody after 30 days suddenly finds that film on VOD. You're already kind of putting it in their head that if it's not very good, I'm not going to go out because it'll be available to me some other way. And what you're going to find is you're going to find that the bigger films continue to get bigger and the smaller films just don't have a chance.
And that's been happening since VHS. People say it's rentable. It's not go to the movies. It's rentable. I'll rent it. I'll wait to rent it. And that's happened. And I'm sure that's had an effect. It's also why, for some periods, you're making more money on sell through and video rental than you do at the box office. But it hasn't stopped people from going to the movie theaters. You know, if you say, well, I think this movie sucks, so I'll just wait another 8 days to watch it on video on demand. Well, if they want to see the movie, it's going to be playing only in theaters. If they don't want to see the movie, well, maybe they'll stumble across it and decide to rent it. But yeah, that is a problem. But we've seen the theaters, go beyond that. That's been a fact they've faced for decades, that people say, well, I'll just wait for it to go to Blockbuster. I'll wait a year before, or I'll wait 6 months and then it's 3 months. And yeah, it keeps getting smaller and smaller, and they're scared it's going to eventually be zero. It will always be day and date. And I empathize with that, but I still feel like, people already, you turn around, a movie's out on video on demand. It's on DVD 10 minutes after it came out in the theater. So I feel like that sense it's always going to become available some other way, it's already there.
I was going to ask you, Jim, to do a little math with me, because this whole thing blew up last week between AMC and Universal Pictures. And it happened in the space of hours. I mean, it literally happened on, I think it was Wednesday or Tuesday. I don't even remember. At 12:30, Jeff Shell said something to the Wall Street Journal, and then AMC immediately responded, and then NATO somehow got involved, the National Association for Theater, and there was like dueling press releases all day long. That said, if you do the math with me, so AMC is owned mostly, a majority owner is Wanda Dalian, the Wanda Group out of China, right?
Yep.
So if that's the case, Wanda also owns Legendary, or a majority of Legendary, which is the production company and financier, which used to have a deal with Warner Brothers where they made the Batman movies. And now they have a deal with, well, Universal Pictures. So if you are Dalian Wanda and you're saying, hey, AMC, play the movies that that Legendary is making that are going to be released by Universal Pictures, how do you as AMC turn to your owner and say, hey, you know what, actually, yeah, I can't do that?
It's a very good question. I guess what I would say is that same conversation happening between Wanda and Legendary and saying, hey, get the guys who distribute your film to make a better commitment to the theatrical experience than what you got now. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to make our money back on all of these Legendary films. You don't know how much say AMC has with Wanda or vice versa. I mean, I don't know the semantics between or the dealings between the two well enough to know whether that's the case or not. But it's interesting, and it kind of gets me to, you know, my general overlook on this whole situation. And I've been reading a few things lately in the trades and on business journals, and I've been seeing a lot of articles that talk about the fact that, well, AMC can't continue to hold this line because they're going to need to play Fast 9 and Minions. Fast 9 and Minions are next year. Right now, for the rest of the year, there isn't, first of all, there's no real film that Universal has until September the 25th.
Which is
Candyman. Quiet Place is Paramount, which is Candyman. And then when you look at the rest of the year, there's not a whole heck of a lot that AMC has to have. There's no huge film. There's no $200 million film there that they have to have. Now, I've been a part of a lot of these back and forth bashings where, you know, I thought that, you know, I'd be out on the exit ramp 101 begging for soup because I ticked off our biggest exhibitor, and they told me to go pound sand. And each time this gets worked out.
It will only be worked out by Universal backing down and not insisting on showing their movies day and date, because none of the exhibitors will show their film then.
Yeah, but I think that what AMC is saying and what Regal is saying are two entirely different things. Regal is basically saying the same thing that they said before all this happened, and that is, if you take our films in less than 80 days if you take your film to ancillary before 80 days, we're not playing the film. That's what they've said for years and years and years. AMC is just saying, right, we're not playing any of your films. And Cinemark has been relatively quiet.
Right. But I'm just saying they won't get worked out by a shortening of the theatrical window between theatrical release and day. That's not the thing. So Universal will back down. Yeah. AMC may cave in. All right, fine, we'll show Candyman because you're maintaining the window. They'll claim a victory.
You know, to me, I think that how this gets worked out is that somebody hops on a plane, goes to Kansas City, they sit there and they chat, and then they come up with a joint statement about respecting the theatrical experience, and it was never our intention not to do anything other than this, and everybody's happy, everybody's thrilled, and on we go.
You know when I think that happens? I think that happens, like you said, during the summer, when Jeff Shell is enjoying a lovely Hawaiian vacation with his family and might be out of the office.
And Donna Langley hops on the plane and goes to Kansas City without telling Jeff Shell. Yeah, that could work too. Yeah.
Well, Jim, thank you very much for joining us. Can you tell us where people can find you online?
Yep.
Besides Celluloid Junkie, by the way, I should mention.
I was going to say, Celluloid Junkie is the first place people should go to find me. Also, you can just Google Forbes Jim Amos for the articles there, and scout53.com.
Well, thank you for taking the time to join us.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks, Sperling.
Well, that was great of Jim Amos to join us. I think he's made one thing clear. Theatrical is not dead. Doesn't matter what it faces, whether it's radio, television, cable, VHS, DVD, streaming, video on demand, theatrical, we'll fight it all off and survive and continue to be a hugely important part of cinema. However, some other people have died this week, so we'll go very quickly through two people. A few weeks ago, we talked about an actress whose career was made by a great casting director. So this week, it's nice to be able to shine a spotlight on a casting director who, a category, as I said, should have their own Oscar nomination. In this case, it's Sis Corman, who died at 93. She was a key player in the career of Barbara Streisand. They met when they took an acting class together. Sis was in her 30s, and Streisand was a kid in high school. She was just 15 at the time. They actually appeared in the film Funny Girl together. Sis had a very tiny role as a Follies performer or something like that. But then she became a casting director. She worked on Yentl and a lot of other Streisand films and ultimately became part of her production company. She also worked on TV projects with Streisand. She also cast The Raging Bull and The King of Comedy and The Last Temptation of Christ for Martin Scorsese. She actually got Sandra Bernhardt into comedy and insisted her son, photographer Richard Corman, shoot Madonna after that would-be singer auditioned for The Last Temptation of Christ. She auditioned, for Mary Magdalene. And, his mom said, hey, Richard, you got to shoot this girl. She's going to be a star. She also did The Deer Hunter and Heaven's Gate. And I love this story. Streisand is 15 years old. She comes over to the house where Sis is with her husband. Remember, these people are in her 30s. And she sort of tells them, oh, I'm going to enter the singing contest. And Sis says, what? What do you know about singing? You can't sing. Streisand says, yeah, I can. And then immediately sings A Sleeping Bee with her back to them because she's a little shy. And they both basically cry and go, oh my God, you can sing. So I thought that's a very cool story.
Well, also, sadly, this story really was, it shocked a lot of people and I think it affected a lot of people because Irfan Khan, who was an Indian actor who was at home both in Bollywood and in Hollywood. He did movies probably in the Western world. We would recognize him for Slumdog Millionaire, maybe Jurassic World or Life of Pi and The Amazing Spider-Man. But he died at the age of 53. I guess he had a neuroendocrine tumor.
That's right. So it's not a shocker because we knew he had this illness. He fought it off to a degree, even shot a new film, but then he was recently hospitalized for a colon infection. So obviously he had a pre-existing condition that left him vulnerable to other issues. And he was really that rare Indian star to cross over. His film debut came with a cameo, really. It's not even that, in Salaam Bombay. But then he went on to play Macbeth in Makbul and a renegade soldier in the award-winning film Pan Singh Tomar. But his two best roles in my book are two movies. One is the lovely the film The Lunchbox, which is widely available to rent. It's not on a streaming service, but The Lunchbox is just a charming, charming film. You really should check it out. And another one was his breakthrough role in a film called The Warrior, which was a great film that I saw at Cannes that most people missed. It never really got a proper theatrical distribution. It's not available to rent or stream anywhere, as far as I can tell, but it's a terrific role in a terrific film. I hope that becomes available someday soon. But if you want to pay tribute to him, checking out The Lunchbox with your wife or husband is a great way to do it. And also dying this week was the Indian star Rishi Kapoor, who died at 67 after battling cancer. He was a third generation movie royalty, a la the Barrymores, sort of a middle of the road actor, always dependable, never really broke out in Hollywood, but always in a countless stream of movies in Bollywood and a beloved actor for sure.
You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do that. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us as well as ways to contact us. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call, you can leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're also on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox. Or Facebook, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox is where you can like our page. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. I'd like to thank Jonathan Handel and Jim Amos for joining us on today's episode. We'll place links to their work in our show notes as well. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week I have nothing. I panicked. I forgot.
Well, you know what? If you can't find any of Michael's coverage on that fictitious website, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his coverage of the entertainment industry is aggregated.
Oh, I know what I got. Jeff Shell has Andy Lack just stepped down from NBC News and MSNBC. There's been a major restructuring at NBC Universal. And California, you maybe have some good news. Gavin Newsom said he's going to start modifying the stay-at-home order within the week. So your rules, I don't know if they're following the advice of the health experts worldwide or nationally, but California is going to start loosening restrictions at least a little bit. That may be good news for the people in the film industry because that's where they're based.
That is true. You know, if that happens, I'm sure we'll be writing about it over at Celluloid Junkie, which is where some of my work can be found. Until next week, play nice.